Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Rurkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today, after we have been covering lots of movies from the present, from the past few years, even, we're going back today and doing one of our classic episodes. We're doing an Oscar rewind of the 1965 Oscars, celebrating the 60th anniversary of all of those films, but in particular, our Best Picture winner, also Best Director, and some other awards, and that is The Sound of Music. I think a wonderful film, a timeless film, and really is a great snapshot of where Hollywood was at the time, celebrating musicals. So we'll talk all about that movie, our favorite songs and scenes, and then talk about the Oscars and how some of those races went, because we have an interesting collection of movies and some winners that are quite surprising. So lots to get into today, and I can't wait.
I'm so glad that we're covering The Sound of Music and celebrating its 60th anniversary. This movie is a really important one to me, and I had the best time rewatching it for this show today, and I have to say, I really enjoyed watching along, looking at your Letterboxd as you watched films from 1965. I thought, oh no, we are in for a rough journey, but not with The Sound of Music. That review was very positive. So we can start there, of course, or, you know, let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start, as Maria says. But what is your relationship to The Sound of Music? Do you remember when you first saw it?
Not really. I'm sure it had played at some point in my house when I was younger, but it was never one that I watched in full until at least a few years ago. I mean, maybe, again, I had seen it before and enjoyed it, but it was never one that I returned to often. Maybe that's the runtime, or not really having a strong relationship with older movies, especially 60s films. We can mention now and later that Julie Andrews had just starred in and won her Oscar for Mary Poppins. And I know we've talked about this in the past when we covered that film, but you loved that movie growing up. And I would say I had a similar relationship with that, where I remember parts of it, but not memories of watching it time and again. So I would say now that I have seen it a few times, it's definitely one of my favorite movie musicals of all time, and I adore the performances. I know when I traveled to Europe, to Austria, to Salzburg, that I'm sure we had seen some of these sights, but again, that was so long ago that it's like, oh, this is from The Sound of Music. Great, but it's not like I had a memory of those scenes in my head when we were there. So I hope I go back and get to see some of them again now that I am more familiar with it, but I'm assuming my relationship isn't as strong with it as yours is. Is that correct?
Well, you're right. I did love Mary Poppins growing up. I was obsessed with her, and really, I think Julie Andrews, both in Mary Poppins and The Sound of Music, she was, I think, just one of the singers, one of the voices of my childhood. I definitely loved Mary Poppins first. That was very important to me and a favorite that we would watch constantly. But The Sound of Music was my grandma on my mom's side, one of her all-time favorite movies. So we watched this a lot growing up. I have vivid memories of watching this as a kid, and certain songs, 16 going on 17, I loved that entire scene when I was little. When they're running around Salzburg singing Do Re Mi, all of that, I just remember loving so much. And also Eleanor Parker as the Baroness. The dress that she wears at the party that they throw, I remember being so obsessed with that look. And when I was watching it again, I thought, you know, it all makes sense. I always love actresses like Eleanor Parker, stars from this time period. And when I think back to some of my favorite musicals or favorite movie musicals from growing up, this has to be near the top of the list, really alongside Singing in the Rain and West Side Story as ones that I remember, you know, falling in love with the vibrant colors and the songs and the dancing, and everything just felt so bright, and it popped. And I loved the actresses, especially. And I thought about this now when I watched it for this rewatch, just how different movie musicals feel now and how I can't always get on their wavelength. But the ones from this time period, I just adore. And The Sound of Music, of course, is one of them. So I had a lot of fun, like I said, revisiting it. I think it flies by. I know it does have a long runtime. It has an intermission, but this is all hits, no skips. I love all of these songs. I used to play quite a few of them on the piano. I was reminded of that when I watched it this time too. So yeah, very special movie. And I know it's a bit syrupy sweet, and we can talk about that with the production and how quite a few people didn't want to make the movie or wanted to stay away from it for that very reason. But I don't know. I think it's a really also just a necessary and important story for the time that we're living in now, too, especially as it makes that transition into talking about the Anschluss and the Nazis in the second act.
Well, a few of our Best Picture nominees do that as well. I love the connections and the coincidences of the time that we're in and the connections to the movies that we pick, just in how that happens. And this isn't the only one, but I think this is the one that connected the best with voters and audiences and why it was so beloved and shown for weeks and weeks on end. And I think before we get into it too deep, let's go into just the summary of the film and how it did at the Oscars. So the description here, a young novice is sent by her convent in 1930s Austria to become a governess to the seven children of a widowed naval officer. This is directed by Robert Wise and stars Julie Andrews, Christopher Plummer, Peggy Wood, Eleanor Parker, and Richard Hayden. It won 5 Oscars for picture, director, film editing, sound, and original score, and had 5 other nominations for actress for Andrews, supporting actress for Wood, cinematography color, art direction, set decoration color, and costume design color.
So getting into the production and the background of this, it is quite a story. I would say there are a lot of twists and turns here where you just think, how did The Sound of Music happen? How did we get this movie that we have today, which became a huge box office success? It was number one at the box office for 4 weeks, highest grossing film of the year. How was this movie so successful? So this was based on the story of the Trapp family singers, which is Maria von Trapp's memoir that she wrote. So this is all about her life, her husband, his children. I haven't read this memoir, but just in doing some research, there are quite a few similarities to what ended up in the film version, but also some key differences. I think specifically in Captain von Trapp's attitude. She remarked that he was not a strict disciplinarian with his children, but that was a decision. You know, it's a movie. We need a little bit of drama there. But the story, I think, was so compelling that producers wanted to purchase the title rights. But she wanted the story really to be shared with the world. She wanted everyone to know her story. So Wolfgang Liebeneiner purchased the rights from her. And then we got a screenplay from that. And there was a film called The Trapp Family, which was released in Germany. Then there was also another version of the story called The Trapp Family in America, which was released later on. And these were both really successful. Then in 1956, Paramount purchased U.S. film rights. So they wanted to then go and make a movie. Do you know who they wanted to be their Maria at first? She's always spiritually connected, I think, to Julie Andrews in some way, shape, or form. Audrey Hepburn. So if you remember, Audrey Hepburn was in My Fair Lady, beat Julie Andrews out for that, even though Julie Andrews is in the stage version.
Mm-hmm.
Julie Andrews went on to win the Oscar that year for Mary Poppins, of course. But this didn't end up happening. And then Vincent J. Donahue actually proposed that this should be a stage musical instead. And then that's how Rodgers and Hammerstein, of course, got involved, developed the music. And the musical was clearly a success. It ran for a very long time. But then they were finally able to move forward with the film. Ernest Lehman, he was tapped to write the film adaptation of the stage production. Robert Wise was actually the first choice to direct this film because of West Side Story, but Jerome Robbins turned it down because he was working on a film called The Sand Pebbles. Have you seen The Sand Pebbles?
I hadn't heard of it until covering this.
I have not seen The Sand Pebbles, but I have not heard positive things. I'll say that. So Wise was attached to the Sand Pebbles. Then they go to Wyler, our dear William Wyler, who I think would have been an interesting director for this. He even scouted locations. He wanted the Nazi character presence in the movie to be even stronger than it is here. But then that was delayed because he was working on The Collector, which is a film that we can talk about briefly, I think, when we get into the best director conversation. But because he was making The Collector, he ended up not being able to do it. Meanwhile, The Sand Pebbles is postponed. That's the next year, and Robert Wise returns. This movie had two new songs in it, so I Have Confidence and Something Good. Those are not in the Broadway stage adaptation. Those are for the movie. And then I think our biggest thing here really is Julie Andrews. So I loved the story that Robert Wise and Ernest Lehman went to Disney to view early footage from Mary Poppins. It hadn't been released yet. She had not won her Oscar, of course, before filming started. And a few minutes into their watch, Wise told Lehman, quote, "Let's go sign this girl before somebody else sees this film and grabs her." So they knew right away she was going to be a star. We have to have her as Maria. Christopher Plummer, who plays Captain Von Trapp, he was not the first choice. He was not popular at the time. He was mostly a stage actor, but other actors were considered, like Bing Crosby, Yul Brynner, Sean Connery, which is just wild. Imagine Sean Connery in this movie, and Richard Burton. So, yeah, it has, I think, a really, you know, unique production history, lots of people involved. Lots of moments, I think, in time where people didn't want to touch it. Wyler hated the stage musical. He did not want to do it at first because he went to see it and didn't like it. So I think his adaptation would have been completely different. But I think the version that we got really works. And for me, that is because the music is so good and so catchy and stays with you. And I really love the performances from these actors.
Yeah, I don't know that a William Wyler version of this would have worked. I love him and his works, and we've talked about many of them on the pod, and getting to watch another of his that I hadn't seen in The Collector this year was exciting. But because he's so character-driven, I think that would have distracted from the story and how magically big in scope it feels as a musical and as a film. And I think taking it too far into World War II and how dark that gets would have just changed the movie. It probably would have changed its trajectory at the box office and changed the audiences. I think this is such a family-forward film that some people who watch it forget about the Nazis being involved at the end. This always makes me think of one of my favorite shows that got cut short from the pandemic, I'm Sorry, with Andrea Savage. It was written by her too. And there's an episode where they show their daughter The Sound of Music, and she's fairly young. And they finish the movie, and the daughter goes, "Mommy, what's a Nazi?" And she's like, "Oh, dang it, I forgot that that was in there." And then she ends up comparing the Nazis to Lord Voldemort from Harry Potter, and it just becomes this big issue and thing for them as a family. So,
oh my God,
it's funny, but it's also introduced in a way that is pretty glazed over. And it's really only in the final act of the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, it's looking at the timestamp when I was watching it, I'm like, wow, we are maybe 2 hours into it, and we're finally getting to the shots of the flag or seeing soldiers march. So, again, I think what we have is very special, and if it were made differently, I don't know if it would have that entire quality to it. And that's what musicals are. No matter how sad they are, the music can still uplift you And that's exactly what this movie does. You know, starting from that first shot when we're flying through the Alps and we zoom in on that hill and we see Julie Andrews spinning and saying the hills are alive. That is such a movie moment. And that is the first thing we see. So I think that's a perfect introduction to this movie. Having been filmed in 70 millimeter, you get all of that beauty, the richness of the colors, and that doesn't stop throughout the entire movie. The reds of the Nazi flag and how scary and horrific that is, contrasted with the natural greens and the browns of the forest and all of the dresses, the garb of the convent, you know, everything. I think it's a beautiful movie in and out. And you know, some of the nominees that we mentioned earlier attest to the work that they did on the film that is so memorable.
Yeah, I think that opening is absolutely perfect. The green and the blue is just so bright. And hearing, like, as the camera swoops down to her and you hear her beautiful voice, it's one of the most iconic character introductions we have in a musical. But I think getting to meet Maria out there, you know, in the wide open space, that just made me think of the great The Chicks song. Like, she needed wide open spaces. She needed to get out of the convent. But anyway, we go to the convent, and then we have, of course, how do you solve a problem like Maria, which is such a fun additional introduction to this character because we get to know what the other sisters in the convent think of her, including Sister Sophia, who I'm not just mentioning because we share her name, but she is played by Marnie Nixon, who famously dubbed a lot of singers in big Hollywood musicals, including Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady, Deborah Carr in The King and I. Lots of great Marnie Nixon examples, but she is here as Sister Sophia. But I love getting to see Maria in the convent too. And, you know, when she first has that conversation with Mother Abbess and is going out into the world to become the governess for these seven children and leaving the convent behind, I think you do know that that's the right decision for her, and then getting to just see her walk through the streets of Salzburg on her way to the beautiful Von Trapp estate. And that new song, I Have Confidence, not the version that Richard Rodgers initially wanted. They changed it up a little bit. They wanted it to feel, I think, a little bit happier, more exciting. But I like how she kind of revs herself up as she's walking down the long driveway, running down it, getting ready to meet these kids who, at first, when she first meets them, they don't want her there, really. And they see her, you know, as naive and a little bit green. She admits to never having been a governess before. So they do all sorts of things to her, putting a pine cone on her seat.
A frog in her dress, yeah.
A frog. Yeah. Oh my God, the frog. So their relationship isn't, you know, it's not off to a perfect start, but it evolves, I think, in the best way.
Yeah, and getting to see how they interact with her and dislike her at first, and then in how she treats them still like their children, but not in a condescending way, in a, I want to help you mature kind of way. That speaks to all of their characters, and how we get to see that develop in the film is another source of catharsis, too, in watching them bond and see how by the end they've changed so much. And everything in between, also, of Maria wanting to make new dresses out of the drapes, and even when Georg comes back and he hates that she did that for them. How much they've bonded with him gone. So she is the mother that they haven't had for a long time. And even though they've had a slew of governesses that just don't work out, we find out it really is the kids and not them in a way that she hints at early on. And Georg is very upset when she jokes with him about that. So it kind of helps that relationship between Maria and him flourish as well, to see how good she is with his kids.
Well, and I think too, Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer, their chemistry is at its best when they are not in love yet, or they haven't admitted that yet, like when they are kind of feuding quietly with their caretaking styles. You know, he's gone all the time. He has different calls for each kid on the whistle and at the beginning, like when he's doing their little whistle calls like Willy Wonka, and they're just like stepping forward and announcing themselves. Everything is so rigid. Yeah. And that is just not her belief at all. And I like how, you know, when Liesl, after she sneaks out to meet Rolf and they sing 16 going on 17, she gets caught in the rain and comes up. I love that moment when she's like saying her prayers and she notices Liesl coming in and she starts talking about her. So then Liesl kind of feels guilty and stops, but she doesn't scold her really or berate her for sneaking out. Instead, she really treats her sort of like she's her older sister, which I think is cool how you get to see her really adapt to each kid. And you just feel as she's teaching them to sing, as she's teaching them to rediscover music, just how important that is for these kids. They don't sing in the house. They've never had that around. And we learn, of course, right, that that was something that was really important in the house when Captain Von Trapp's wife was still alive. So then there's that added layer of pain, which I think, you know, when we hear them performing The Sound of Music, when the kids are singing that for the Baroness, and he hears that and he starts singing to join them. That is just one of the best moments, I think, in the movie. It always moves me and makes me teary-eyed when you hear him sing with them.
Yeah, and I think that's what this movie, having won all its Oscars and done so well, is the emotion that it gets across through the music, through the characters, through its development, and how it moves so quickly, I think, as a movie, but how it flows together. And it's those moments of vulnerability in everyone, especially the captain, because he's so strict. And yes, the whistle is so funny. It's like, because of the time, he wants his kids to grow up to be strong people, but they're still kids. And I think that's the great contrast between Maria and him, and in seeing how they force their ideals. I know that sounds strong, but the motherly and fatherly love into them, and that he finally understands in the end that, you know, he has been missing his wife and really pushed that aside and tried not to think about it because of how much that hurts. But instilling that into his kids and allowing them the memories of that allows himself to feel whole again. So I think this whole next bit of the film, until we get to the intermission, these songs, 16 going on 17, and then we have the storm and all the kids are scared. My Favorite Things, I think that's maybe my favorite song from the movie.
Yeah.
And then Climb Every Mountain, and the big climax we have with Maria leaving after the Baroness, who is just so evil in how simply she states things to Maria and wants her to leave secretly so that she can have the captain by herself, especially after she sees them interact together and see like what that chemistry looks like. I mean, yeah, I love Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer together, and they're so young. But then when she leaves at the end, it's just, we're left on this cliffhanger. It's a great intermission. And then we come back and we still have great music. You know, we still have Do Re Mi yet to come, and that important theme of Edelweiss that Plummer also comes back around and sings again later on.
Is this when I can talk about the Baroness and how much I love Eleanor Parker?
Oh, God.
I know she's technically a villain, but I think this
Please do.
Perfect performance, because yes, she is mean. Like, I understand, like, she is kind of wicked. She wants to send these kids off to boarding school. Like, when she's like, a delightful little thing called boarding school. That makes me laugh every time. She really is just like a complete foil to Maria in every way. So obviously she doesn't want her around, especially if she wants to marry him. And I think what I like about her as a character is that she's also rich. She's not trying to get the captain's money. She has money of her own. And she has another line at some point where she's like, she wants a man who at least needs her money desperately. That's so funny. She just always has these little reads for other mm-hmm. characters. I like her dynamic with Max too. And I feel like you feel so much from her performance. Like, she is heartbroken at the same time. You can feel all of that in her eyes as she's watching them fall in love with each other and realizing that that's not the relationship that she has with the captain, and that her time with him is coming to an end, and she doesn't want to be the mother to these children. She wants to send them off to boarding school. She just wants to have her next marriage, and she thinks he's the one for that, and that's fine. She's just so glamorous too. And I think that, you know, when you have virtually two unknowns like Christopher Plummer and Julie Andrews in the movie, they needed a well-known actor. They needed a star here, and Eleanor Parker, she just really delivers, I think, in every turn. The more and more I think about it, I think, is she my favorite performance in the movie? That feels crazy because we have Julie Andrews here, who is perfect as Maria. But I just fixate on Eleanor Parker as the Baroness. I love her. And she's the best dressed character in the movie.
You're totally right. She's beautiful. Now that I'm thinking about it, barely anyone has like a big blow up scene. Like a big Oscar scene. I would say Maria has that to the biggest extent, but she never like storms off. She kind of just accepts her reality mm-hmm. in a quieter way once Maria comes back and her and Mother Abbess have had that conversation. She's like, dang it, she came back. You know, I understand it. But it's kind of surprising that that doesn't happen, I guess, especially for a villain, if you want to call her that, or, you know, someone who is meddling. But I think to kids, they wouldn't see her as a villain really either. I don't know. She's not made out to be like Cruella de Vil in a way or no. something like that, which is, again, another reason why kids can really understand this movie on a different level.
Yeah. And I think that the movie itself, like, the movie does feel like it is geared towards kids and families really early. Like, I think when we are with Maria at the convent, and even in some of those earlier songs, I think especially Do Re Mi and My Favorite Things, those are absolute classics. And as a kid watching it, you can't help but get just totally swept up in watching these kids learn how to sing, watching them run around with her. I love when they're climbing the trees when he's driving by and sees all of them up in the trees. And he's like, what are those kids doing? Not realizing that they are his mm-hmm. own playing, because they would never do that. But then I think as it shifts into becoming about, you know, more difficult themes like Nazi Germany, like the Anschluss, Captain von Trapp being this, you know, naval hero and his commitment to his country and his resistance to the Nazi party taking over, I like that even though the shift doesn't really come in a serious way, I think, until after the intermission, we get little moments of it that in the script that do feel more adult. I think specifically in the conversations between him and the Baroness and Max of what's going on in the world and how the tides might be turning, things might be changing. So I like how it's done pretty delicately. And I think when you're a kid, you don't really notice that. Like, when I think back on my time watching this when I was younger, it was really the songs and Eleanor Parker's fabulous outfits. And it's like the second act after the intermission feels like that's when we get that much more adult version of the musical. And it's funny because earlier, like I mentioned on last week's episode, I saw earlier this year, I saw Cabaret, and I think that movie incorporates Weimar Germany and the rise of the Nazis in Berlin at that time and what was going on in the world in a much smarter way, I think, throughout the script. But that musical itself is way, you know, more avant-garde. I mean, it's Bob Fosse. And I think especially more adult in the way that it deals with its themes. and what people choose to ignore or not ignore, what they will face, what's going on in the world. Whereas this feels, I think, very focused on one family and how this affects them. And I think, though, as we get into that second act, that's when we get the wonderful image of, you know, as they're trying to pressure the Von Trapps into hanging the Nazi flag and joining the Third Reich, when he tears that swastika, it's perfect. Still one of the best images in the movie.
Yeah, I loved that. I looked on YouTube just to watch some scenes again, and I just put in Sound of Music, best scenes, and the first video is just the 14-second clip of him ripping down the flag and in half. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that is my favorite shot of the movie. Again, you have that rich red and how angry he is, and he just rips it in half before the kids can see it. So yeah, it definitely gets into those more adult themes. But even before the intermission, we get to see also the importance of class and the fact that he is a hero, but he's so wealthy that they host this big dinner party. And there are other officials there. There's one guy who's really against him not showing his support of the Nazis with the flag, mm-hmm. and that he's hanging the Austrian flag only in his house. And that is an act of solidarity and resistance, but he doesn't relent on that. And I think that's, again, another note of his character and why we end up liking him so much throughout the movie, despite maybe how terse he is towards the beginning and acts towards his kids. We know that deep down he's a genuinely good human being, and that I think sticking up for him and his family in his household is just another moment that we get to feel supportive, but his courage also.
I was just really, to be a little too sincere here, very inspired by his courage in particular. I feel like that's not something we are seeing a lot of in the world or even in films. I think he is quietly and pretty devastatingly heroic at times in the movie. And whether that is embracing music again with his family and learning to lighten up a little bit and really join them in this new joy that they found from singing with them or just watching their puppet show with the Lonely Goat Herd. I have the biggest smile on my face during that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, moments like that or tearing the Nazi flag and fleeing with your family, your entire family, you know, leaving that beautiful house and your entire life behind to avoid serving in the Third Reich. I don't know. It felt very profound watching it.
Yeah, I felt the same way. And, you know, the final sequence of the movie is also really tense. This is when we're at that festival and they're singing. Max finally got the kids to sing in that festival, even though mm-hmm. Georg didn't want them to. But he uses that as a way for them to escape. And every little thing that happens and every scene that happens in this just adds to the intensity. Like as they're trying to leave the house without the motor running and the officials catch him, they say, oh, what's happening? Oh, my car wouldn't start, but then it does. And they take them to the festival and then singing So Long Farewell one more mm-hmm. time. It's like, I love every time the kids are doing that at the party, at the house, and then here at the festival in that huge stadium. And I love the lighting in this scene too, but they leave and, you know, they end up hiding in the convent behind those headstones, and they're hiding from the light that is being shown in front of them to see if they're there. You mm-hmm. feel so tense, like you are being quiet, you're not breathing, watching this because you're scared for them. And the way that he and Maria look back at each other while they're huddled over the kids, I think that's one of the most important moments in the film. And we see his total transformation. And then his confrontation with Rolf outside and him trying to have Rolf put the gun down and not whistle that they've been found. So there's a lot in the end that brings all of the emotions together and kind of releases once they're gone in this final moment of congratulations, and you feel so happy and relieved, again, that catharsis of that they're safe, that this is a somewhat happily ever after, despite what they've had to go through and the state that the world is in this moment, you can still feel some hope for the future.
I completely agree. So I think now transitioning to the Oscars. So our other Best Picture nominees this year, we had Darling, Dr. Zhivago, Ship of Fools, and 1,000 Clowns. I watched Ship of Fools and 1,000 Clowns for the first time for this recording.
How did that go?
Well, I'm very happy that The Sound of Music was the winner. And that the two that are really remembered well, I think, are The Sound of Music and Dr. Zhivago. Ship of Fools and 1,000 Clowns felt very of the time. I think Ship of Fools in particular, I was very excited to see Vivien Leigh there. I'll say that about it. 1,000 Clowns, I had to venture over to YouTube to watch this. The quality was not great. But I think Darling lives on a bit just because Julie Christie won Best Actress for that movie. But yeah, The Sound of Music, I think, out of this lineup, really has stood the test of time. And I would say Dr. Zhivago has too. Those two, for me, are the ones that really rise above the rest here. How did your watches go?
I was going to say, you saying, well, I thought of Dorinda saying, not well, bitch. Because that's...
Oh my God.
That's how they went. I struggled through those two as well. I felt Darling was extremely dated, and I think 1,000 Clowns is an awful title for that movie. I said, where are we getting this from? They felt like stereotypical Oscar nominees. I'll say that Ship of Fools has this great ensemble cast, but you start with this fourth wall breaking introduction by Oscar Werner, who had won prizes that year. He won the Golden Globe, and people thought maybe he could win the Oscar. He was nominated in Best Actor for this, but he opens the film with, oh, this diverse ship of people isn't so different from you and I. And I just rolled my eyes and said, oh boy. And this is a long movie. I also watched The Great Race, which was nominated. That's a long movie. It's just all of these very 60s, I would say maybe mid-60s films that I had a bit of trouble with. Looking at Best Picture and Best Director, our only overlaps here are for The Sound of Music, Dr. Zhivago, and Darling. And it was surprising at the time that Stanley Kramer for Ship of Fools didn't make it in Best Director. Instead, we had William Wyler for The Collector, that film that he worked on instead of The Sound of Music, and Hiroshi Teshigahara for Women in the Dunes. These two movies, I would say, are more my speed, more maybe our speed in Oscar Wilde. But I guess it makes sense that they didn't show up in picture. They're very different, much darker films. I'm really struck by Woman in the Dunes.
Yeah.
I will say for Dr. Zhivago, too, I love that movie. I mean, that's David Lean. It's surprising that he didn't get nominated at DGA. So he was even surprised that he showed up in director here. But that kind of dinged him from, I would say, winning at the Oscars. So The Sound of Music was kind of the one to beat. And obviously it won both of those prizes and went home the big winner of the night with 5. Dr. Zhivago also won 5. But these two are epic in their own way. And I can also understand that Dr. Zhivago is an even bigger epic than The Sound of Music. But it is much darker. And we get into more of the nitty-gritty of the Russian Revolution and the politics of the time, which I could see voters having a little bit more trouble with. Also, David Lean, we had Lawrence of Arabia already, and maybe they, you know, saw The Sound of Music and really wanted to award Robert Wise as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think The Sound of Music was just too dominant, and I feel like it's just a movie that is a bit easier to get swept up in as far as a story goes. I think Dr. Zhivago can feel like a bit of an endurance test. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's actually a pretty great film. I oddly, though, prefer, this might sound crazy, but I prefer David Lean's smaller, more intimate films like Summertime and Brief Encounter and The Passionate Friends to these like large-scale romantic epics. But I understand why those are also the ones that are remembered, the Lawrence of Arabias and the Dr. Zhivagos. But yeah, I think The Sound of Music was just way too far out front. And it's interesting that Julie Christie won for Darling and not Julie Andrews for The Sound of Music, just because I think her turn as Maria, that's just such a tour de force movie musical performance. But if you actually look at what happened that award season, Julie Christie won a number of prizes. She won the New York Film Critics Circle. She won NBR. She also won the BAFTA. So I think there was also really an urge to reward her that season. And I really actually do like that performance. I think I'm a little bit higher maybe on Darling than you are. I definitely think it's a portrait of the time for sure. But I think she just captures that swinging 60s feel in London very well. So I enjoy her performance. But I also think, you know, when do they give actors back-to-back wins? It's pretty difficult to find examples. There are cases where it happens. Louise Reiner, Julie Andrews certainly would have been a better two-time winner choice, but they're harder to come by, I think, especially one right after the other, two musical performances, even though she was in the Best Picture winner. I think if this happens today, she wins in a walk. If The Sound of Music is the Best Picture winner, Julie Andrews comes right along with it, regardless of whether or not she won the year before.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely different in how we look at the Oscars today, because also at the time, Julie Christie was fairly new to Hollywood. Looking at where both Julies were at the time, and they're only a year apart, they're only in their first four or five films ever. So I think the fact that Julie Christie comes on has this film Darling, but also Dr. Zhivago, where I was maybe expecting her to have like this bigger role because of the film, but I'm like, no, I understand why she was up for Darling instead. But because she was new and could do so much, people loved her. It makes total sense why she won this year instead of Julie Andrews, who had just won the year before. And for a similar thing, sure, maybe, that was part of it, but I still would have voted for Julie Andrews because it's just, you get to see her yodel and sing, but also act so well in this movie. So I understand it. This is Julie Christie's first nomination and her only win, but she has a few more along the way. Are there any other categories you want to shout out? Or wins that you like from this year?
Well, I did want to mention The Collector briefly. I know you talked about it a little bit in Director, that being one of William Wyler's nominations. We didn't cover this movie on our William Wyler episode because we just covered his wins, which he has three, which is pretty crazy. So we just did Miniver, Best Years of Our Lives, and Ben-Hur. But I found this movie to be incredibly dark. I did not expect the ending to go there. And I think now watching it through a modern lens, you know, we have so many crime thrillers and crime dramas that you can really look to or compare it to. But back then, this had to be pretty scandalous when it came out. And I know Samantha Eggert and Terrence Stamp both won Best Actor and Best Actress at Cannes that year. So I don't know. This felt really ahead of its time for me in a super dark way. And there were so many times when I was watching this where I just thought, no, like, get out. You can. So, oh, this is a story about this man played by Terrence Stamp who collects butterflies, Silence of the Lambs vibes immediately. But he collects butterflies and he becomes obsessed with this woman and kidnaps her. And the entire movie takes place at this remote rural house where he's imprisoned her. Like you said, Wyler is such a character-driven director, but it feels so different, I think, from so many other films in his filmography, where I was almost surprised that it made its way to the Oscars, because I don't know how to describe it without getting into spoilers. So just watch it if you like crime-related anything, really.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you like Wyler and you just want to see something different from him. It's also based on a book, which oddly I have, but haven't read. So I'm going to read the book now, but we'll see.
I wasn't sure if it had been remade, because I feel like it would have by now. But I compared this to, or I would recommend, Peeping Tom by Michael Powell. This is one of the Archers that comes out in 1960. So this is beforehand, and very similar dark vibes, and really just kind of makes your skin crawl a bit.
Yeah.
Just the things that happens in this movie just makes you so frustrated. But also I understand that that's the point of this movie. But Wyler, again, yeah, these two characters, the relationships they have and how we get to know them, and that ending is really bizarre. This kind of does have a connection to Woman in the Dunes.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this?
Yes. The connection is weird, too. Like that they're both bug related.
Bug collectors. Yes.
Like two bug collector movies in Best Director. I don't think it's happened since. I hope it doesn't happen again, if I'm just being honest.
Yeah, these are two very unsettling films. Very different. But yeah, Woman in the Dunes really just has stuck with me. And especially for this time, I'm so surprised that it made it into director. Its only nomination. And it was one that won one of the top Cannes prizes that year, along with The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. But again, this feels very much like a now kind of thing where we look at award ceremonies. So I love that this made it in, but I'm also shocked in the same way.
Yeah, this is a mesmerizing film. I think this would be my vote for director. It has really stayed with me. And this was a first time watch for me too, for this episode. And the directors will really go their own way sometimes. I mean, yes, Robert Wise won and it connects to the Best Picture winner, of course. But if you look at these nominees and just the differences, it would have been very easy for them to just go with Stanley Kramer, like you mentioned, or even Fred Coe for 1,000 Clowns. The options were there. I saw a disturbing Letterboxd score from you for The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is one of my favorite movies ever. But I would have put Jacques Demy, of course, in here too. I'm surprised you didn't like it, only because this is Damien Chazelle's like number one influence on La La Land, which I know you love.
The talk singing is like really hard for me, and it took nearly half of the movie to get into it.
Okay.
But I will say the colors, as vibrant as The Sound of Music, as rich as anything we've ever talked about on this podcast, and the fact that it didn't win or wasn't nominated in certain categories, including art direction, color, like how did that not get in? But that to me is insane. Like, yes, I didn't love the movie, but I think there are aspects of it that are definitely remarkable. But just interesting how the Academy voted this year, I will say. I mean, but it did win the Palme d'Or, so it was celebrated in certain ways.
We'll always have the Palme d'Or. I also just briefly want to point out one of the funniest nominations in Best Music Song. What's New Pussycat was nominated.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but I know what that is.
Yep, of course. I also have not seen it, but I know what it is.
Well, looking at other movies nominated, I haven't seen this, but The Agony and the Ecstasy reminds me of The Robe. So maybe this is in my future.
Mm-hmm.
And I also do want to mention before we ask some of our final questions, that For a Few Dollars More came out this year by Sergio Leone, the second film in the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly trilogy. That is my absolute favorite. And this wasn't nominated, and I think it absolutely could have been in sound or editing or score. There's so many areas. But again, just strange how they cling on to certain movies that, again, are very of the time. Or I watched The Great Race. I don't know if there are other strange films that you have seen, but this is like a mix of Looney Tunes and Around the World in 80 Days or Rat Race, that kind of a vibe.
Well, I also will say that Thunderball came out this year, which is one of the Connery Bonds, and I love that it won Best Special Visual Effects, and there were only two nominees in that category, just Thunderball and The Greatest Story Ever Told. I've been rewatching or watching for the first time a lot of Bond movies this year, and I highly recommend it. It has been so much fun. I found that I really like the 70s Roger Moore Bonds, which might sound crazy because I think most people gravitate towards the Connery Bonds, which I love, but I've been having so much fun with the silly campy ones from the 70s. So I recommend it.
I think in another way that you, I feel like, would like or recommend The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, a Jean Le Carré film and one that Richard Burton was nominated for this year.
Yes, I do recommend The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. This is also one of my favorite movies from this year. I think it's probably my favorite Jean Le Carré adaptations. You haven't seen it, you said?
Mm-mm.
I would watch it. It's really good. This would have been my adapted screenplay winner, too. I haven't read Dr. Zhivago, and it makes sense that that won, but this wasn't even nominated, and it totally should have been.
Well, I think this is a perfect segue getting into if we think anything was snubbed, because I think The Sound of Music not getting into screenplay, I don't, again, know if that's a rule thing, but it is adapted. It kind of makes sense that that would be in here. But then also with Christopher Plummer not showing up, I think that's a travesty looking at the Best Actor lineup. And even if you were to say, okay, put him in supporting actor, we have Martin Balsam, who delivers the second shortest supporting actor win ever in A Thousand Clowns. And I was waiting for him to show up, and I'm like, that's it? He's in it for 10 minutes? So I'm like, we could have absolutely found room for Christopher Plummer somewhere in this lineup. So that's kind of appalling.
I agree. Where was Christopher Plummer? When I was looking through the nominations, I thought, how did that not happen? That feels crazy. I mean, I guess Christopher Plummer, he wasn't incredibly well known at the time, but he was also dubbed in the movie. I think his voice, if you listen, you can find clips of his voice singing the songs from the movie, and it is good, but to go up against Julie Andrews like that, I understand why they went with a dubbed vocal.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if that had any effect on it. My biggest snub, though, is obviously Eleanor Parker. How did she not win? She's not even nominated. It's wild to me. I do not understand it. I'm just going to keep banging this drum. You know, I like Shelley Winters. I'm happy she has her Oscar. But Eleanor Parker absolutely deserved to win here, and even if she didn't win, at least a nomination. I truly don't know how this happened, because this woman had 3 Oscar nominations already. It's not like she was one of those people who she wasn't Donald Sutherland, you know? Mm-hmm. So how do they miss her? How do they skip over her? She would be my winner. She's my biggest snub.
Well, we have a double nomination from Othello for Joyce Redman and Maggie Smith. And we also have Ruth Gordon here for Inside Daisy Clover. Would you have switched out Peggy Wood as Mother Abbess with Eleanor? Or would you leave Peggy if you had to make that kind of a decision?
I mean, if we're only going with one nomination from The Sound of Music, it absolutely should have been Eleanor Parker. Like, she would have been my one. But let's kick out Othello. this is a really poor adaptation. Let's just get rid of the movie altogether and start over. And we can make room for, we can kick out Laurence Olivier. Obviously, mm-hmm. Let's get rid of Laurence Olivier, best actor. Let's put in Christopher Plummer here. That's easy. And let's get rid of both Maggie Smith. I'm sorry, I love Maggie Smith, but we don't need her in Othello. And Joyce Redman. Let's get rid of both of them. We can get more Sound of Music people in here. That's fine. Mm-hmm. And how do you think today's Academy would receive this movie?
I think they'd receive it really well. Also, now we're seeing a lot of double-digit nominees, so I don't think 10 is crazy for this movie to receive today, but I think it'd be widely loved and supported at the box office. We also have Wicked to look at for that. I would hope it wouldn't be made into two movies, but I think it'd be very well matched in wins and nominations. I think it could absolutely still win Best Picture. What do you think?
I think so, too. I think especially if it was such a big hit, it's timely, it's relevant, the performances are pretty amazing. It's funny that you bring up Wicked, because I actually thought of Wicked when I was watching this. It doesn't remind me of Wicked, but I thought about how they split Wicked into two parts. If you were to split The Sound of Music into two parts, like let's say we just split it at the intermission, I think you would have a similar problem that I fear Wicked for Good is going to have, which is that all of the best songs are in the first act. The first act is stacked with songs. Mm-hmm. Like all the songs you think of when you really think of the musical are there. The second act is much darker. So it'll be interesting mm-hmm. to see how they pull it off, because personally, I think it works better as one piece of material, right? As one artwork, one musical, but they went with the money. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, I think the Academy would receive this very well today.
And if you could give this movie one Oscar, what would it be?
You know I want to pick Eleanor Parker, but I'll give it to Julie Andrews. I'm going Best Actress for Julie Andrews. I think that this is a stunning movie musical performance. Her vocals are absolutely out of this world. And you believe Maria in all of her emotions, everything that she's going through, her love for Captain Von Trapp and for the children every step of the way. I love her doubt when she goes back to the convent and runs away from it all. I think it's just a fantastic performance. So I'm going to go Best Actress for Julie Andrews. What about you?
I'm going to do the same. There are a lot of elements that I love, including Ted DeMacord's cinematography and Dorothy Jeakin's costume design, but I do love that win for Phyllis Dalton for Dr. Zhivago. It's everything you said, everything we've talked about this entire episode. I think you watch this because of how good Julie Andrews is and what she brings to the screen and how she brings this family together. It's about Maria from the start of this movie, and I think she's such an interesting layered character, and Julie Andrews adds to that depth and allows the audience to see all of those different characteristics of her personality. So you love this character, and it's to no surprise. I think a lot of that is due to Julie Andrews and what she can do. And, you know, we saw that in Mary Poppins the year before, but we get to see, I think, a new side to her in a totally different way than we had because of how good of an actress she is. So you can tie with Eleanor Parker if you want, but I think Julie Andrews is a great win. I'm glad that this movie did win 5 Oscars, mm-hmm. but it also, I think, deserved it in many places too.
I think so too. And I think it's one of those movie musicals that will stand the test of time, and hopefully on its anniversary, when it comes back out in theaters, more audiences will discover it. We'll have new viewers who will fall in love with The Sound of Music. I think it really is just one of the all-time classics. And I'm glad we got to discuss it today. Even though some of those 1965 movies weren't the best, we also got to discover some new gems as well.
Yeah, I love talking about this today and rewatching The Sound of Music. Go watch it if you can. It's also in theaters via Fathom Events right now. So check your local theaters to see it on the big screen, hopefully still showing in 70 millimeter because the colors are fabulous. Thank you all for listening. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and Blue Sky at Oscar Wilde Pod. And we have bonus content on our Patreon at patreon.com/Oscar Wilde.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time.